Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finished yet. It took me a long time to get here.
Both parents have spoken with each other and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their asses for 10 years.
So we're nearly there, Conor. The clubs in the north are back training. Lucky enough for them. Inter-county training is back on Monday. The draws for the championship are next week. I don't know, I can smell the freshly cut grass, Conor. I just can't get into the Portlaoise grounds to actually kick on the freshly cut grass, but we're nearly there.
not long to go now, Willie. I think I passed the pristine Calchemaggio grounds there around the weekend. They were in cutting the grass, so the grass was just cut. There's nothing like that smell, especially when the evenings are like this, so nearly there. Just hang tight for a couple more weeks and we'll be back.
Yeah. And the draws for the 2021 championship, they're being split up all over the place. They're going to take place in RT next week. So the Munster football is at 7:35 a.m. on Morning Ireland and the hurling's at 8:35. And then the Leinster championship is going to be on Tuesday on Morning Ireland. And the Connacht and Ulster football championships are taking place on the 6-1 news on Monday and Tuesday, respectfully. So I don't really know what RT are doing here. I suppose everything together is a full show in itself. They obviously don't want to do a full show in itself. Not sure why they don't want to do that. Any thoughts on it? Like, I mean, they do rugby shows. Why couldn't they do a championship draw show?
I don't know. I can't believe that Munster hurling is stuck away in Morning Ireland at 8:30 a.m. The Connacht Championship is given pride of place in the 6-1 news. That was the biggest surprise for me. My takeaway, Willie, from it was at least that you know, we're used to the GAA Championship draws. The only problem with them is that they take place about 8 months before the championship actually takes place. So at least that's not happening this time, you know, and at least, you know, I kind of like the idea that come Monday and Tuesday, that's when the draws are being made. That's when the inter-county teams will be returning. Do you know, so they might go back to training. Well, that's when, if they haven't been doing anything so far, which they shouldn't be. But they'll be going back to training on Monday, Tuesday night and maybe have a bit of a bounce in their step, knowing who they got in the draw. You know, if Galway got a Mayo or Tyrone were to draw Donegal, for example. So, but I don't know why necessarily there's no TV kind of draw to kind of give it a bit more pizzazz before the start of the league and championship.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. Inter-county training goes back on... Inter-county training goes back on the Monday, you know, the Monday night for the championship draw as the TV show, I think might fit pretty well. But I've already mentioned the clubs in the north of Ireland were allowed back training on Monday. And one of those clubs was the great Cross Maglen Rangers. And Aaron Kernan joins us on the line now to see how that went. How's it going, Aaron?
Not too bad, Colm. Not too bad.
We were saying that this is the only time that the six counties in the north will accept being treated differently to the rest of Ireland.
Yeah, I'd say that's a given, particularly around Airneck it was. That would be for sure. But yeah, it is. It was, I have to say, and it was brilliant. Just to head back up to the club again Monday evening, freshly cut grass. nice calm evening for us, and just great to see a lot of the boys' faces again, which unfortunately, just the way things have panned out, we haven't done for coming up in 7 months now.
7 months, this is crazy. Like, was it mayhem up at the club with one team finishing, the other team getting out, you know, coming and going?
It actually wasn't, because to be fair to the club, last year, just coming back whenever COVID restrictions were easing, we brought in a new COVID officer who was basically overseeing pitch selection or pitch time slots. So it all was done in advance, because we've known for a number of weeks now when we are allowed to go back. It was all done in fairly good order. Right. So by the time our seniors were coming onto our training pitch, which was at late, that was at 8 o'clock. The only other teams that actually were left in the far field from us was an under 15 team, who are managed by Tony McEntee. So he's double jobbing with Sligo and our under 15s, which is great to see. So yeah, we were the only ones that were still out at that stage tonight. So it was it was great to get back out onto the field again. I have to say it felt like a lifetime since we last did it. And yeah, it was brilliant. It was one more step in the right direction for us all.
So we were hearing there at the start of the show about a team in East Belfast who, on their first night out, did a HIIT session and did some sort of a long run. What did you do? Crossmaglen Rangers, surely to God, will use the ball the very first night back after 7 months.
We did, to be fair. Now, over this past number of months, obviously, we've been given our own programs to do in terms of running and strength and conditioning and that there. But no, the management would be very conscious that, I suppose what happened this last year was, whenever we went in lockdown, there's nothing really in Cross in terms of public parks or whatever to do any running. So with the pitches right. being strictly closed at that stage, we found we picked up an awful lot of injuries and soft tissue injuries whenever we come back last year in terms of hamstrings, groins and that. So I think they've used the knowledge gained from last year to prepare properly for now. So no, it very much was about just easing boys back in. Like I said, we have been doing our own bits and pieces of running, but it was the tempo runs that are the new things now, that boys were doing a bit of. But one of the other big aspects was just getting used to the ball and kicking it again. I bought 3 footballs myself about a month ago, and I was heading up to the field just to do a bit of kicking with my wee boys and that there. And to be honest with you, like, you were aching after, because I just literally hadn't kicked the ball at that stage for 5-6 months. And it's just using muscles differently, kicking around the corner, trying to kick for distance, kicking off the outside of your boot. You don't find that, having not done it for such a long time, you do be aching. So it was a matter of easing in all aspects in terms of your running and your skills.
Well, that's it. 13th of September was your county final. So, geez, you've had a long time to dwell on that county final loss, Aaron. Like, I mean, 7 months without, usually you like maybe get out early the next year and get over it and play a few league games. It's a long bloody time to be sitting idle. I presume there was a good few of the lads way out of practice.
It wasn't actually too bad. As I say, it was kept fairly basic. It didn't get too hectic, to be honest with you, but fitness wise everyone seems to be in fairly good nick. There couldn't be too many complaints, I would say, from that. Our team too, you would have an awful lot of them that are younger, that there would probably be college and that there, so they've had plenty of time to keep themselves in good nick, and to be fair, only for it, having something to do, you know, in terms of giving you a bit of a program to put some structure to your weeks. Winter was fairly grim for everybody. So, from our point of view, it looks like a lot of the boys have used whatever bit of spare time they had to get out and about and do whatever bit of training that they could do for their own sanity, more so than anything else.
Yeah. So have you played a little bit of a match yet in training? I presume you were out again on last night. Have you swung over a pint yet?
Oh, I have, absolutely. usually you'd have your 3 or 4 boys who would stay behind after training, and they'd be pinging shots over the bar. Basically, everyone was staying over, and the worldies off the outside of the boot from the sideline, the whole lot. Everyone was getting in on the act. But yeah, we did sort of try to cover everything in terms of your foot pass and a couple of shooting drills. Last night then was maybe just a wee bit of a step on where it was sort of trying to reenact movement more than anything in terms of getting the ball from defence into your forwards and just trying to get everyone starting to think about their game and think about the roles in terms of what position they're in, because literally it has been so long since we've done it. That's more what last night was, and I have to say it was very enjoyable because it's just because we haven't done it, and it's an aspect that I suppose you can get great benefit out of in terms of being in defence, knowing where you have to move, you know, if a keeper receives the ball, knowing where you're going to deliver it, and then again having your forwards that their outlets in your half forward lane, your full forward lane, and starting to work on just a wee bit of movement that it has people thinking and a bit of enjoyment to it as well, as well as putting a bit of structure. So I really enjoyed that last night now, because it put a wee bit more of a game related feel to the thing, which was great.
I'm going to have to let you go, Aaron, for the mental health of a lot of the listeners. When you start telling us about staying back after training to kick scores and have little mini competitions, I just don't think people can deal with this anymore, Aaron. I'm going to have to let you go. I'll talk to you later. Thanks, Aaron.
Take care, Colin.
We can only dream, Connor, to be back kicking a few scores over the bar and being back out on the pitch. I know you're positive about the club situation, but we really are in limbo. I know the inter-county starting on the 19th, but we have no idea yet when clubs, you know, in the south are going to be back.
Yeah, just before I get on to that, well, it's funny you say that about the north, because or Northern Ireland, because Lee Costello, he joined the sports show team in the last couple of weeks. He's involved with the East Belfast club. So I was asking him there on Tuesday morning how training on Monday night went. And he said that they did a 5K run in a HIIT session.
Ah, Jesus.
No, they said they didn't see a ball at all. So now the plan was to incorporate the ball into training as the kind of the week went on. But that was his first night out. So
no, wait. But that's criminal. Like, I think any manager in the country that gets their players back for the first time, an inter-county manager, surely, and to do something that they would have been doing and bored of doing for the last 3 months. That's criminal.
It is. I couldn't believe it. Because, like, it's bad. And, you know, we've talked about this before, when it's terrible when you go out for a session and, you know, you see the bag of balls there and the manager might say to you, oh, don't worry, you don't have to worry about them. You won't be seeing them for the evening. And that the impact, it kind of has a morale. So you can only imagine that after being absent for how many months and then being told, no, no balls tonight. We're just going to do exactly what you've been doing individually for the last how many months.
But I accept the fact that the manager has to see where your fitness is at, but don't do that on the night they get back. Do it the next weekend. You know, let's do, okay, lads, we'll see where you're all at fitness wise. Everything has to be with the ball the first week. Jesus Christ, as a team. Oh my God, I think I'd go home. I don't think I'd do that session.
I'll have to follow up, but that was the Monday night now. I'll have to follow up with Lee to see how the rest of the week went, but I couldn't believe when he said that to me anyway.
Jesus. But right. Go on.
As for the clubs down here, well, yeah, I don't know, am I being kind of swept away by the optimism by hearing that various, you know, the inter-county is back, that the training in Northern Ireland is back. You know, we're hearing stuff on the 4th of May that more stuff might be opening. So I know, have I been kind of swept away by that and the combination of the good weather by expecting the club to follow? And maybe my enthusiasm will be dampened in the next couple of weeks. But I just have a good feeling that, you know, come the first couple of weeks of May, that it won't be long till after that, till the clubs are allowed back.
Yeah, definitely should. So antigen testing. I don't know if anybody listening knows much about antigen testing. I kind of read up about it because a lot of countries in Europe have been using antigen testing for a good while. And of course, in Ireland, we're so late to the party. It's only been considered by government now. Because the Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, who's very worried about how many times he's tagged on Twitter by the department, he's just received a report from the COVID-19 rapid testing expert group. Now, give me a bloody break. Anyways, each of these tests costs £5, right? And that's compared to €150 for a PCR test. Now, some people think the PCR test is the gold standard. The antigen test, they say, is not as accurate. But I go so far as to say the antigen test is actually better, because PCR tests pick up asymptomatic carriers that are not in any way infectious, whereas antigen testing pretty much picks up your positive when you're kind of in that 8 day, 2 days before, kind of, you know, or a couple of days after, where you're actually infectious. Because I don't want to get too boring. One looks at RNA of the virus, the other looks for specific proteins that are made, and you only have them when you're actually infectious. If you're to ask me, antigen testings are €5 compared to €150, and they're better. Anyways, But we're only looking at them now. So the thing about this is, Leinster Rugby have made a submission to the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts and the Gaeltacht, is to start using antigen testing to get some supporters into the ground. So what they want is you buy a ticket for the game, you come to the game that night with your negative antigen test that you took during the day and your ticket, and you go in. Now, they want no more than 2,000 supporters, which is about 11% of, presumed that's the RDS, RDS capacity, and they're going to separate them right throughout the ground. Now, if it was up to me, if you come with a negative antigen test, I'd be getting way more than 2,000 in there, and, you know, not a full stadium maybe, but anyway, so they're being very cautious and careful with this. And the Leinster Rugby CEO, Mike Dawson, said it's a suggestion. We obviously have a couple of matches coming up in late May, and it's a possible way of getting crowds back in through the turnstiles. It's not only for rugby. This could apply to Gaelic soccer or whatever. So the FAI got wind of these antigen tests, what Leinster were doing, and they're in talks with the government about replicating Leinster's initiative by returning fans for League of Ireland games. Now, this all seems very positive to me. It seems, you know, very proactive. And the GEA have no plans to use these antigen tests. Like, I mean, I don't know. It just really frustrates me. Like, I mean, Peter McKenna was quoted in the Irish Times. He says that would be the ambition would be to see some people allowed into the stadium by the end of the summer. That would demonstrably show that we're getting back to normal. There are issues with public transport, etc. And we'll keep an eye on how that works in Britain. Like, I don't know, Connor. Like, I mean, why would the GAA not want to use these antigen tests and get supporters into the league games and do what Leinster Rugby are doing? What are they afraid of?
So, yeah, I'm not saying I disagree with you, Willie, right? So I'm trying to answer the second question there, is in why the GAA mightn't do it, let's say, right? So just looking into it. So that report that you're on about from Stephen Donnelly, I think that the publication of that was only fairly recent, I think. So it maybe only became possible for the likes of Leinster Rugby or for sporting organisations to submit proposals as to how they might use antigen testing to get crowds back fairly recently. So that's the start, right? And then I would imagine that, so you're talking about the Leinster game there. Trial games have to take place first. So I think the Leinster trial game, they're saying it's going to be as early sometime next month. And then I was looking into it and I saw that the League of Ireland, the possible date for a League of Ireland trial game would be the 21st of May. Right. So by that stage, the Hurling League and the Football League will both have started. And I don't know, the only other thing I can read into it is that Leinster Rugby's professional organisation, Leinster Rugby Professional, the League of Ireland semi-professional, whatever, that if it was to be implemented for league games, that would be up to the individual counties to have to do it. And maybe they think that there's not enough time to organise that for the National League. And maybe think that, like, well, if we're going to do it for anything, try and get it in place for the championship, which would be.
But Peter McKenna is not saying for the championship. Like, I mean, the championship starts in July. Maybe is that what you're reading into it?
That's what I was reading into it, that they might look to delay it for the league and then do it for the championship instead. Because by the end of June, you're talking about having 80% of the population vaccinated. So if you're not, I couldn't understand a reason why you wouldn't be looking at the prospect of getting crowds back into games at that stage.
Yeah, I would have been pushing antigen testing since January. It's working in Europe. Like, I mean, I understand it, but I think the GAA are slow to lobby this stuff. You know, they can put pressure on government for stuff. Like, for example, what about the 1 million that have been vaccinated already? Why can't they go to the league matches? Why are the GAA not saying that's 1 million people out of the how many million in the Republic? 4.5 million. Why can't the GAA be proactive to say, why can't our vaccinated members now go to games? Do you know, like, I see them just always waiting to be given permission. Do you know what I mean? I think that they're almost, like, we know from last summer, the GAA is actually more conservative than NPHET, if that's even possible.
But you think, Bill Woolley, that all stems back to, well, the GAA was more conservative at the start. Then they got kind of, you know, a bit confrontational towards the end. Maybe they asked for a direct response from NPHET. I think that was towards the end of the summer. And then what happened then was all the stuff around the club games, which obviously contributed to a lot of COVID cases. So I don't know, is the GAA maybe being seen a bit, you know, a little bit reluctant to put its head above the parapet, especially given what's gone on with the Dublin footballers and the Monaghan footballers with public breaches of the regulations in recent weeks.
They are looking for money from the government to run the league. So I suppose they don't want to rock the boat, but it's definitely in their interest. These antigen testing, instead of saying we're not looking at for the league, I'd love to see, like what you said, look, we're a little bit late for the league, but that's absolutely something we want. We want to get, 10,000 people into Croke Park with negative antigen tests, and we want to have a decent summer. Wouldn't that be a lovely message to send out? Instead of, no, we're not looking at that right now.
And Willie, it's a legitimate message to send out as well, because for my sins, I happened to be looking at a Oireachtas committee meeting the other day where Ronan Glynn was talking. And he was talking about the implications for if 80% of the population are vaccinated by the end of June. And he was saying that, like, he sees large tracts of society being able to open by then, even for, like, he was saying that there's been suggestions that, fully vaccinated people will be able to do, they could go to games as you suggested. But he was saying that, like, by that stage, the disease, if 80% of the population are vaccinated, the virus should be under control to the extent that, you don't necessarily have to be vaccinated to be able to go back to and kind of normal things, whatever. So, like, I don't ask me to go deep into the implications or the science of that, but I took that as a very positive sign. And from a GA point of view, it tallies perfectly with, if 80% of population vaccinated by the end of June, the championship is just starting. And at that stage, some degree of crowds to be able to get back in and give the championship a proper summer feel with crowds back there as well.
Exactly. I'd say there's as much chance now as of 80% of the population being vaccinated by the end of June. Now, my poor mother was supposed to be vaccinated last Thursday, this day last week, and they rang her up and they put it back for 3 weeks, not just a few days, not just a week, 3 weeks, the poor woman, terrified at home, looking forward to getting this vaccination, and they sent her back 3 weeks. So I don't know, the end of June, they haven't reached any target yet. So I don't see why the end of June, I don't see how the end of June target is even remotely possible as far as I'm concerned. Anyways, I'm not getting sucked into that conversation. I'm sucking myself into that conversation. I'm not saying you're doing it to me. Dublin have lost their home advantage in the league. Monaghan, Cork and Down. We mentioned this last week, but it's interesting that Dublin won't have any home games. So in the National League, obviously, there's groups of four. So you have three games. So you have some teams would be lucky and have two home, one away. Dublin had two away and one at home, and they've lost that. That's against Kerry, so it's in Portlaoise. And I think the same thing has happened with Monaghan, Cork and Down too. So they're all going to be on the road for their league games. So I suppose Dublin will have a little giggle and say, Jesus, we play all our games at home. Look at us now.
Yeah, I mean, if I saw the joke about Dublin having to play their home games in Croke Park as opposed to Parnell Park, if I saw it once, I saw it a million times after the breach there last. But it seems fair. I mean, they're still only losing one home game, and whatever about their other teams, I expect it to have minimal impact on Dublin's league campaign.
Yeah, Larry Murphy had said that after this, and I suppose they're a little bit late with this quote, but anyways, it came out after last week's show. He says, I think it has done us, he's talking about Dublin, Cork, Monaghan, more Dublin and Monaghan, they're the more recent ones. He says, I think it has done us reputational damage, which we're going to have to work to get back. There's no appetite for any breaches in society at the moment. So undoubtedly it has. Now, there's no appetite for any breaches in society. I'd change that in society with on Twitter or on social media, because I don't see the same reaction when I speak to people about Dublin getting caught or Monaghan getting caught. I don't see any outrage in the people I speak to in person. I just see that online. And I don't think people are themselves online. I think they're fake. I think they pretend to be people often that they're not perfect. They never make mistakes. I don't think there is. And this reputational damage, there's people out there, Connor, that hate the GAA, and nothing's going to change their opinion of the GAA. The Grab All Association, a lot of soccer fans you'd hear it from. I don't think it's done the GAA any reputational damage really at all. Maybe I'm gone too extreme on that. Yeah, a couple of counties stepped out of line. I'd actually go so far as Dublin and say this team thought nobody was looking at them, and they're still trained in a group of nine with no contact. Like, I mean, if anything, this is incredibly responsible. Monaghan probably a little bit more. They all went together on the same pitch. But you paint the picture of Dublin, reputational damage. This is a team that thought no one were looking, and they're still so responsible and, well-behaved that they didn't even do a contact session. They just did a non-contact. They followed all the rules in secret, Connor. Like we could actually twist this around to say that the Dublin should be applauded.
Well, listen, I don't know if we go that far now with the embarrassment. reputational damage. I don't think the Dublin or Monaghan incidents in isolation or maybe even collectively did the GAA reputational damage. I would say, Woolly, that there's been reputational damage done to the GAA over the last year or so. But I think that's more to do with what happened after the county finals towards the end of last year. I think there was a big reaction to that. And I think, you know, in a lot of cases it was justified. But you made a good point there. You're not going to get away from the fact that some people just don't like the GAA and are going to use any opportunity they can to bash them. Do you know what I mean? But I think, Larry McCarthy had to say that to a certain degree as well, because he's speaking as the head of the association with two fairly high profile breaches, that it did do reputational damages. But I would query, as you did, I would quibble with his line about there's no appetite for any breaches in society. There's no appetite for any breaches maybe to be called out publicly. But as we said last week, there's a lot of people, you know, maybe having a go on Twitter of people and then not looking in the mirror because they're probably breaching said regulations themselves.
Yeah, I would like Larry Murphy to have commented on saying, you know, the chances of catching it outdoors is very, very minimal. It's 0.1%. And, you know, these lads weren't, you know, in any way, you know, risking public health. I'd like for him to have done that. It can't all be, you know, kind of going on the same road of giving out. Anyways, to move on from that, Connor, hurling teams, right, have only 3 weeks preparation for the National League, right? So we have the dates. So they're back training on the 19th of April. And they only have until the 8th of May. Now, the 19th of April is a Monday. So they only have two free weekends before they start on the 8th of May. Now, then they go in to five league games in 6 weeks. And then they have a 2 week break to go into a Leinster and Munster league styled championship. Jesus, now that is tough going.
Yeah, no, it is. Like we kind of said that last week, and I think I was pointing out maybe specifically the danger of players who they can't, they're simply, whatever they're doing individually won't be able to replicate what they're doing in a game, and that what's likely to happen as a result. And I think we saw this maybe more in the club game when it came back last summer, was there's going to be so many soft tissue injuries as a result. And the only thing I'll say on the back of a Woolly is that, like, there had to be a balance there between trying to get a decent season, you know, and then, you know, given counties enough time. So that 3 weeks to me isn't enough. But then did they need that time to fit in a reasonable league campaign?
I think the league is going to be seen as to a certain extent it is anyways seen as a warm up competition to the championship. But I think the league is going to be more like one of the January competitions where players are going to be tried out. There's five games in hurling. The first three will be three completely different teams probably put out there. And they have to do that. Like, I mean, they have no choice. Like Mikey Kiley, who's the Limerick S&C coach, he said a 6 week preseason is more than ample. He's actually arguing that preseason in GAA is too long in a normal year, you know, like a November, December, January, like a 3 month kind of one. He's saying 6 weeks preseason is enough for professional players. And that's what we see ourselves at. He's talking about the Limerick hurlers. You cut that in half now. So, like, I mean, there is no question that the league, especially the first three games, you know, and maybe when players have played one game, taken a game off, you know, are building up that kind of resistance to actually play in a proper competitive game, that maybe in the last two hurling games and in the, there won't be a final, the last two hurling games, we might see them ramping it up a little bit. But I wouldn't be expecting much from round one, two and three.
Yeah, well, whatever about the Hurling League, Woolly, what I was thinking about kind of how, even when we were saying there that the championship draws are being made next week, I think that, I know a lot of planning will have gone into training already, but that might dictate how certain teams train towards, you know, how they kind of scale their training over the coming months. Because if, say, an Ulster championship team is if, say, Tyrone were to meet Donegal, you know, in the first round of the Ulster championship, they might be trying to peak for that, as opposed to if they didn't get a game in the Ulster championship, which wasn't as maybe competitive. Do you know what I mean? But it's interesting what Mike Kiley says there as well, because he's on about professional athletes. So he's taken the fact that, like, these lads they're training the whole year round anyway, but it's different this time because they might be training the whole year round and they might have been doing what they've been doing individually, but they're still coming in on the back of 4 months of having doing individual training and have to change that to collective training. So, like, I think Limerick are the best conditioned team possibly in the GAA. They'll be okay. You know, and they have such a big squad that they'll be able to rotate.
They'll rotate, yeah.
Do what they have to do. But I think it's probably the lesser teams, you know, that don't have the don't have the kind of the luxury of being able to rotate as much as Limerick do, that will probably suffer over the course of the league.
Yeah, Mike McGurn has been talking this week. He's another S&C guy. He's worked with the All Blacks. He's worked with the Ireland rugby team. He's worked with Everton. He's worked with a lot of Gaelic football counties as well. And he's complaining about the training load. He says a lot of county teams are doing training that has no relevance to Gaelic football whatsoever. One of the fundamentals that we look at, kick, catch, put the ball over the bar and tackle. It doesn't take much more than that. And yet we're doing things that have no relevance to that, but it ticks boxes. And I don't agree with it. He said it's not what you can lift in the gym or what you can run on the track. It's what you do on the Sunday on the pitch. And like, I mean, you know, I couldn't agree more with that, really, because I know you have to have your body in a certain shape. But like the amount of old 5K runs and you know, old nonsense that really doesn't have everything should be done with the ball, pretty much. There's very, very rarely you should have the ball or the hurl or the slitter out of your hand, because all those like the aerobic fitness drills and all that stuff, it can all be done. And there's actually a huge value in doing a really hard run and then having to execute a skill of the game, like a kick or a point when your legs are tired. That's what separates the great players, is decision making when you're tired, because when you're really tired, it's your head that goes just as much as your legs.
Yeah. It marks out the great players and the great teams, with the ability to do that under pressure, as we've kind of seen, or while fatigued, as we've seen the last couple of years as well. Like, Mike McGurn to me is spot on about the GAA mentality. Do you know, as in, like, if the team down the road is training four times a week, we should be training five.
Yeah.
And it's more about the quantity. People don't necessarily care about the quality of the training. The fact that they're doing more thinks that they're, you know, they think that they're going to be naturally fitter kind of as a result. And he's also right about I'd love to hear him kind of dig a bit deeper into that, and you know what he thinks, you know, what specifics that he thinks that GAA inter-county teams are overdoing it on, because you know I'd 100% would agree with him that the priorities are wrong in terms of there's not enough focus on the skills of the game, and there's probably too much focus on the S&C side. Although I probably would say that I think that's been redressed in the last few years from what I could see. But it was interesting as well, Willie. Mike McGurn said that you know, 4 weeks of a preseason isn't nearly enough for an inter-county team, and you're balancing that out with Mikey Kiley saying that 6 weeks is enough. So, like, these guys are, you know, right at the top of their trades, and they kind of have different opinions on kind of what works.
Yeah, it's like all these, they've all got different opinions. Like these scientists telling us to stay in our houses, they've all got different opinions on everything as well. Jesus Christ, why can't you all agree on something, like letting us out of our houses? But it is the truth in the GAA. Like, I mean, I remember even the 90s, you'd go away for a weekend and you'd be allowed out, have a few pints, and they'd be like, you can have these few pints, but only on the condition now that we're up training at 7 o'clock in the morning and we'll run that beer out of you. And it's like, would it not be more beneficial now to let us sleep until 11 and get a good night's sleep and then maybe run the shit out of us at 11 o'clock if you want? But this idea that, you know, the whole idea will run the beer out of you. Like, I don't know if there's any science behind that other than an urban myth.
There is no, and it's interesting, like I know I've heard of a couple of stories of, like, say, GAA inter-county training camps in recent years when they might go away for a week. And that was the initial thought originally, that they'd train hard for a week, and then maybe if they're leaving on a Friday, on the Thursday night they'd have a big blowout, and then, you know, run it off them on the Friday and then go back. And then the thinking has changed completely, where that's a complete waste of your time. And the way they were doing it more recently was they might go out on their first night there, recover properly the next day, and then have, you know, they then train properly for the week. When they're coming back, then at the end of the week, they can feel that they have a body of work done, and they can feel the benefit from it as a result. So, just the science of it is kind of is obviously getting better, which is great, because what you said, you know, with the tradition of kind of getting up in the morning and running the beer out of you, while, you know, it makes for a few great stories, probably heard them over the years, from a scientific point of view, it doesn't do you much benefit at all.
Yeah, the obvious one is dehydration and muscle tears. There's the very obvious ones without getting too much into it. So Terry Hyland's not a fan of Zoom calls, Connor. Who would have thought this now? So this is in the Irish Times. He said, everything in sport and life comes down to trust. So, okay, I'll keep reading the quotes. Everything in sport and life comes down to trust. Says Hyland. When it comes down to it, we've given the players programs to get on with it. And the basic fact of the matter is that it's either up to them to either do it or don't do it. We'll know in a fortnight when we get them together who's done the work and who's only half done it. You trust them to do it because they know when they show up, they'll get back out on the pitch, whether they have done it or not. Instead of an hour and a half on a Zoom meeting, wouldn't it be better if they had that hour to go and take on the responsibility for themselves? Because in the end, your work shows up on the playing field. And I don't know, does somebody need to tell Terry Hyland that Zoom meetings aren't about saying, did you do the run? Yeah, everybody do the run, put up their hands. It's not about interrogating players whether they did the runs or not. I presume Zoom meetings are about staying in contact with each other and a little bit about team bonding. That's important. There might be new lads on the panel playing a few games together, maybe having a drink together some night. Maybe, like, why is he associating a Zoom, an hour and a half Zoom meeting, with finding out how much training they've been doing?
When I read the quotes first, Willie, I was thinking, has Terry Hyland just decided to manage a club team instead of a county team? that sounds like the kind of a Zoom call that that club managers throughout the country are doing. Like, if Terry Hyland is in trouble, if he thinks that he has to check in with his players that they're not doing programs at inter-county level, it definitely happens at club level, but it shouldn't be happening at that level.
What would it do then at club level? Would they literally go around to each individual and say, are you doing it?
They might do that, but like there's more of a danger of club players not doing it as opposed to inter-county. That was my point. I mean, like if Terry Hyland feels the need to check in with these lads, you know, that they're not doing it, well, then he's in trouble from the start. I said,
but is it that his understanding of a Zoom meeting? His understanding of a Zoom meeting is basically to go around each member of the panel and waste an hour and a half asking them, did they do the running?
Well, the line there, wouldn't it be better if he had that hour and a half to take on the responsibility for himself? Because in the end, your work shows up in the playing field. That to me sounds like that's how Terry Hyland is interpreting the need.
I think so, yeah. I think someone needs to explain to him the benefit of his players seeing each other face to face and the whole panel interacting and maybe having a bit of crack together.
Yeah, well, you know, you mentioned it there, I think, about like maybe having a drink. Didn't the Dublin lads do cooking contests on Zoom?
Yeah.
Limerick lads did something similar. And they spoke of it. They spoke of it unprompted, I think, after winning the All-Irelands last year. So, you know, it obviously made a difference. But I can maybe have some sympathy with, like, Terry Hyland might have misinterpreted why to have Zoom meetings. But I can see where he's getting at in that, like, it, you know, it doesn't take long for Zoom fatigue or virtual call fatigue to sit in. I'm just thinking, this time last year, we were, what, only a few weeks into lockdown, and everybody was doing Zoom quizzes. Everybody was doing online bingo, virtual drinks, anything to meet up. You know, and then to have any sort of connection. And then it gradually sort of faded out. So the worst thing you could do in this situation is keep doing it, you know, if you have to force it. Do you know what I mean? There's no point. You just have to let it go if that's the case. So maybe if we, you know, Terry was to elaborate a little more, that's the type of thing he'd say. But from what I could see anyway, he's misinterpreting the point of having these Zoom meetings in the first place.
Maybe he is. Maybe Terry Hyland's old school. He's probably, he'd be on the kind of tick side of personality-wise, a bit like myself. I don't mean that as an insult at all. I like kind of contrary kind of men. He gives me that impression. And he's not entertaining these Zoom calls. And listen, that's all right with me. Like you say, though, maybe there's more of an explanation. I took the quotes I thought were very funny. Well, no, the whole article didn't really show that he had an understanding of the benefits of Zoom calls. But we're probably trying to kind of be too kind to him now. One more article here I thought was interesting, and that's the Irish Times as well, is players' Instagram and sponsored cars. Now, I'm very interested in sponsored cars, Conor, because I'm dying for a sponsored car and I've never been offered one. So I take a lot of interest whenever I see about players having got a sponsored car. Again, I've definitely said this on the show before and still no offer of a sponsored car has come my way. But anyways, look, that's OK. I won't keep going on about it. But this is more about the Instagram stuff, right? So this is Trevor Twomley. He's a co-founder of sports management agency Sports Endorse, and they're representing about 100 GAA players. I hadn't heard of Sports Endorse before reading this, but Trevor is the co-founder and he was given some information about how much players are making on Instagram. Dean Rock, this is in the article, Dublin's Dean Rock can command 1,300 per sponsored Instagram post. I nearly fell off my chair. He has nearly 37 followers on the social media platform. Galway footballer Damien Comer can demand 665 per post and a third of that for an Instagram story. Tipperary Jewel star Orlor Dwyer, who's over with the Brisbane Lions, she can charge 830 for a post to her 24,000 followers. Did you have any idea they were making that kind of money on this? Like, I mean, I was shocked.
No, I'm shocked as well, Willie. I would like to know how many sponsored Instagram posts Dean Rock might do in a year, for example. Because say if he was to do one a month, you know, he's making close to 15 grand, would he be? If he does two a month, you're up on 30 grand, which is like an auxiliary salary for himself, really. But I'd love to know kind of how much, you know, how many Instagram sponsored Instagram posts Dean Rock might get a year. Because I suppose I was just kind of comparing it to, let's say if Dean Rock did a media day for a certain brand, I'm sure he'd get that same, you know, that same amount of money. But and players would do maybe, you know, four or five of those a year. So I didn't know the level of money that they get, Willie, but I don't necessarily kind of begrudge them for using their profile to kind of make a few quid aside as well either.
Oh no, I wouldn't be giving out about that at all. I've gotten one thing like that. It was a mobile phone company. I think I got a free mobile phone. I think I got 3,000 euros for about 10 social media posts. There was 5 on Twitter, 5 on Facebook. And like, I mean, I wasn't active on Facebook at all, so that didn't make much sense. But I put in a bit of effort into the tweets and tried to make them kind of funny or whatever. But like, I mean, nothing like that has ever come my way before or after that. But that's, I suppose, maybe 3 grand with 10 posts, which is 300 a post, which I thought, like, I mean, I was delighted with that. Like 300 for just typing a tweet. What the, this is fairy tale stuff. But like, I mean, 1,300, like, I mean, it's just off the charts for typing out a tweet.
On
Instagram. And all this stuff happens on Instagram. I went off Instagram. I found it the most fake, boring, absolute nothing app I've ever had to go on in all my life. I completely deleted it. You will do nothing, only waste time in your life on that app.
Yeah, but really, loads of people waste time on that app, right? So, like,
that's what it's for.
Exactly. If I'm wasting loads of time of an evening, I'm likely to check out what Dean Rock is doing on Instagram. You know, So whatever brand is paying him that money, that's their job done. And just to go back to even that comparison with the, if Dean Rock was doing a media day, what would happen is he'd do a round of interviews, the brand will get a mention, you know, it'll go out in all the newspapers and websites. But like, you can, via a sponsored Instagram post, for example, you can reach that target audience more directly. You could probably be more explicit about it. Do you know what I mean? It's not a mention tucked away in the bottom of an article.
Yeah.
And you're channeling an audience that, you know, on a platform that they engage with more than they would do, you know, on newspapers and websites and stuff. So like, you know, I don't know, do they make this, you know, like do the brands make the money back? You know, is it worth their while? I'd say it is. But just, you mentioned sponsored car. Like, if I see Dean Rock driving a sponsored car, am I necessarily going out and buying it? No, but I could tell you any intercounty player I follow, I probably know what sponsored car they're driving. So yeah. The job done for the brand as well.
Brand awareness. Yeah, that's the thing. But like, I mean, how do you quantify any advertising? You don't really. It's just been proven to work. However, it just plants that seed in your subconscious, it absolutely works. And there's no huge way of kind of quantifying how much it works. Jeez, without getting really stupid, I often think of like a Pepsi ad, and Beyonce's paid like 10 million to come into this ad. And I'm like, how many feckin' cans of Pepsi do they have to sell just to get back the money that they've paid her? Never mind pay all their employees. And anyways, I'm talking complete nonsense now about how sometimes advertising would confuse you.
You need to get back on Instagram and earn money, Willie. That's your
well, whatever it takes to get a sponsored car, I'm willing to do. That's okay. I'm just going to say that.
I thought your ship might have sailed because you stopped playing, Willie. But Paul Galvin is still doing well off those Audi posts long after he's retired. So, you know, you need to tap up some local dealer in Port Leash.
Yeah, and we know, listen, I'm a media personality here, Connor. I have a lot more on offer here than just an ex-player. You have to remember that. I have to talk myself up here. I usually talk myself down. Anyways, last story of the day. The Donkeys Don't Win Derbies. I was very disappointed during the week when I read this. So this was in the Echo Live. This is the second week we've done a piece from there. So Donkeys Don't Win Derbies. This is the, and we did the, it was 1990, I'm fairly sure. And Tipperary were defending All-Ireland champions. And the whole story along was that Babs Keaton had said before the Munster final, donkeys don't win derbies, which was a complete insult to Cork. And this rattled Cork so much and riled them up that they eventually beat Tipperary in the Munster Championship. They went on then and actually beat a fancy Galway team in the final. And this actually, he didn't actually say donkeys don't win derbies in the context of Cork hurling at all. Like, I mean, he was asked by Ger Canning, of course, you have to respect the team motivated and trained by people like Father Michael O'Brien and Gerald McCarthy. And Babs said, you still need the talent. You still need the players. Several managers in recent weeks got credit for being great motivators. But if you don't have the talent, you can't win a derby with a donkey. And that was it, Connor. He never actually said it at all. And I couldn't believe it, because it kind of has gone down in history as one of the greatest kind of almost insult trash talk in the history of the GAA, and it wasn't even meant.
Yeah, and that's a fair enough comment as well that Babs made, wasn't it? Do you know that, like, you know, you could be the best, basically he's saying that you could be the best manager in the world, but if you don't have the players, you know, it's not going to be any good to you. And I think that's completely fair. But because it's Babs, because of his personality, and because it is, even though he probably didn't say it as it's been quoted since, it is a very good quote. But it just goes to show you, why was that, 1990? And now we're 2021 and you're only finding out the story behind it now. And just shows you that's how things like that can stay in the public consciousness, even if there's only a grain of truth to them, you know, that long after, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe I'm a bit slow to it, and maybe other people did know about it. I'm not too sure. It just came as a big shock to me. So maybe some other people might not have known the story. Right, we'll leave it there, Connor, and we'll come back with Bernard Flynn.
Come here, I want you to talk us through the goal you scored in the county final after 15 seconds. I want you to tell me when you had goal on your mind.
Yeah, you've probably had a few 15 seconds experiences yourself. Break me off, show me what you got, because I don't want
no 1 minute man. So Meath legend Bernard Flynn is on tonight's Laker Gael. It's on TG Cahir, as we know, and it's on at 9:30. It's a great show. I watched it this morning. And Bernard joins us on the line now. Congratulations, Bernard. I watched it, like I said. It's a great show. It's a bit of a roller coaster from the highs of winning All Irelands to the lows of crippling injuries and losing your entire business.
I know. Listen to me. I'd be running out the door, I think, when it's on, because when it's about yourself, well, it's a little bit different. And you try to come across and give the message honestly, and it's not moaning or groaning in any way. To the contrary, it's actually, you're not, there's no way of feeling sorry or anything like that, but just trying to give us a little bit of a story to the man behind football, if you like. And yeah, it was a little bit raw, and I think the good, the bad and the ugly is in there somewhere, as you said yourself, but I hope people get something out of it.
Yeah, well, that's it. Well, I suppose the raw kind of part came towards the end, where you're lying in a hospital bed, you're in there for a week after a hip operation, the crash had just happened, you just lost your business, which was valued at 29 or 25 million, you know, and you're kind of explaining that's the worst, like it doesn't get any lower than that.
Yeah, and probably with the show, it was hard to get in. I would have loved to explain to some people the pitfalls, and I have actually done that since with younger people or people in business who became sort of got into trouble and became sort of embroiled in stuff that I had was involved in. So it doesn't matter. The value is irrelevant. It's just I built a substantial business from nothing on my own, and I was so proud of it. But when that crash came, and it's hard to get that message across, literally, it's like something, a tsunami, when they called back in the loans and a very good business model. It was going for 16 years, the same company, from nothing. And then overnight, you lose your business because they call in their loans and they close in on you, and the foreclose, that's it. So that was just, I mean, pretty horrific. But listen, it is what it is. I'm a big believer, Willie, in your own wins, you own them, your own losses, your own mistakes. And I'm from the school that, listen, you got to get back on the horse again and try and get going with a young family at the time. So it wasn't easy, but listen, I'm expecting no, there's no feeling sorry, nothing like that. You just try and get over it. But it was very, very, very tough and pretty traumatic. And there is scars, and anyone says there isn't any scars when you go something like that. Of course, there's a few scars, but you get on with it and you dust yourself down. You just get going again the best you can.
Well, you're naturally a very positive person, and you're a people person. Like, when that was all happening to you and it was blow after blow, like, I mean, did you hide away from people? You know, how did you deal with it?
That's actually a very good question, and there, you know, it is. And no matter, and I would be strong with adversity, or I'd be strong with issues or problems, and friends of mine would come to me, and I'd be a go-to type of guy for that, and love helping people anywhere I can. At any turn, I love to help somebody. But you do. I had my dark days. I had my tears. I had my sleepless nights. I had many of them, Colm. And I swear to God, that is the truth. I probably didn't say that to that extent in the program, but I had many, many of them. My wife included. Sat down with the kids. They were phenomenal through it all. I mean, phenomenal. So, yeah, plenty scars, and I had my dark days and lonely days. And you do. You do shy away. I learned very quickly, friends, that, you know, behind your back, they'd be saying things. Those things never bothered. I never cared. A bit like yourself, I never really cared what anyone said about me. But and that stands me in that situation. But what is tough is when you face people just after the moment it all happens and goes belly up. You have to look people in the eye. And you know what I did? I stared them down. I met them. I probably hid away for a week or two to get my bearings together. I'd lost my hip. I'd lost everything. I had no car when I came out. The business and all was gone. So, listen, and then after the few years after, you're fighting to save your own family home. That's on the line and all that end of as well. So there's a good bit more there. I'm not the only one. I won't be the last one. And as I say, wouldn't the likes of Jim Steins, Holly O'Shea, Adele Dying, and Michael's wife was in the programme and stuff like that. So there's an awful lot of people I know would love to have the problems. And I do say, and I believe it now, I still am one of the lucky ones, a great family, three wonderful kids. And hey, you get a few injuries, you get a few knocks, and you get back up and you get going again. That's it.
The injuries, we'll get to the injuries in a little while, but like all that sounds absolutely terrible and, you know, really hard to live through, but it could have been even worse. You were very close to playing for Loud, Bernard, because you grew up in Drogheda and only your father built a house on the right side, as you would say, of the River Boyne. We might never have heard of you.
Oh, Jesus, Colin Kelly was on to me yesterday. And I know Seamus O'Hanlon, I know Stephen White, I know so many of the judges and all the boys up there, Teppy Smith, them all. I mean, I have some great friends, a great town. I mean, I socialised them and the crack and the fun. There's a whole section of the programme, Willie, that I'm looking at the programme when I see that. I said this to Sean, I'm after saying that Sean Boylan rang me just before we went on air here. I said, Sean, when you look at the fucking thing tonight, I said, I did a whole programme of divilment, crack and fun and stories, and I said there's none of them in it. So he says, I could write a book, he said, about you and the Carry On, you Beggy O'Malley, whatnot. So I had great fun in Drogheda, there's no doubt, but thanks be to God my father built the house on the right side of the River Boyne, as you said, the beach side, but 500 yards, and people don't realize it. I was in school in Drogheda, in primary school and secondary school, and I probably would have ended up playing in Loud, which a great GA town and football town. But yeah, it was that close, and that's the fine margins that I wouldn't be speaking to you today, more than likely, if you had stayed in Drogheda where we were living.
I thought it was a funny line out of you in the show. You said when you went in onto the Mead panel, you thought some of the older lads were a bunch of savages. Who were you referring to as the savages?
Well, that's actually probably a nice name of what I really thought about it. And I sort of elaborated on it a bit, but in fairness to the show, it was probably 6 hours footage that has put into 50 minutes approximately.
Yeah.
So I get it, and they've done a great job. I mean, they're great people what they do, Ron and Sarah and Keane and that. So what I'd answer you there is that, I mean, the likes at the time of, you know, Mick Lyons, Horrick Lyons, Kerry McEntee, Liam Harnan, Colm O'Rourke, when I say that, it was daunting, and I wouldn't say they particularly liked me when I was in first. I might have had a bit of gel, a bit of Brill cream, a bit of. These guys didn't even know what a deodorant was. You know, they didn't know. And I would bring stuff in the bag, and it was a bit probably ahead of me time with maybe a little bit of Mali like that. And I was like something out of Mars when I came in first with white shoes, a change of gear, change of clothes after a match, that type of thing. A young fella, 18, 19, but they knocked the living shit out of me at training, and they sorted me out very quickly, I can assure you.
I'm sure they, so like, I mean,
we're still savages.
The like, you weren't a typical Mead player because you were small. Like, I mean, you could look after yourself, but like, I mean, you can take it as a compliment. You've been kind of like a pretty boy, which was not the Mead look at the time.
Totally. I mean, I'm being honest, it was even worse than that. I was no more equipped. I played minor in 83 and under 21 and senior in the same year. I came in, Sean Boylan, a great story. I actually said it to him only 15 minutes ago. Sean, do you remember the night you invited me into the panel with Robbie O'Malley and myself? We won the junior final in October. Sorry, end of September. and you came straight over to Eastmead outside Drogheda to a hotel. We were all out of our minds drunk at 12:30 or 1 o'clock, and you came straight across the room, sat down with myself and Bobby when we could hardly speak, and said, lads, I'm bringing you to meet senior panel. That's what actually happened. He made that time to drive an hour that night in the junior final. Wow. I was no more equipped to go in there than the man in the moon. I mean, I don't know, there was no sweat condition, and I was a scrawny, skinny 10 and a half stone. But listen, you had to just try and, you know, organize and get some, you know, find your own mechanisms to survive and different things. And listen, it took me a while, to have to say, and they had patience with me. And I probably really shouldn't have probably made it on that team, because I was against everything what they stood for, really, you know.
Well, that's it. But like, I mean, the footage of you, like, I think it was the 84 Centenary Cup, you got your break kind of in the first team. It was the semi-final, you got 1-3. The footage of you getting that 1-3 compared to the league you won in 1994, you were a much stockier fella by then.
Yeah, I mean, you learn. I started to do, those days there was no real gyms. I mean, honestly, and people, in my own son, and it just laugh. It's so funny when you're working with young lads, even. I see the programs and what's been done with the under-20s now, even myself and the coaches and all that, and of it, very virtually, with programs, what we're doing with them at the SSC side. But I just did the basic stuff, Colin. You might be the same. I did my press-ups, you know. I had small little sort of old weights, sit-ups, push-ups, press-ups, all that type of thing, a little bar on the top of a door that you pull-ups, all that. So it was basic stuff to make yourself stronger. But I started to eat. I mean, my diet was shite when I went in there first, absolutely dreadful. I mean, you know, but I would say, the only, I did 7 days a week I did practice. It's the only, my wife, God help her, she's about 20 yards away from me here now. I mean, I mentioned football. 7 nights a week I practice, and our dates at the time, I had five sisters, and Drogheda was like the Miami of the East Coast. And the crack and the fun at night. The biggest problem myself and the Mali and that had was to stay out of Drogheda and stay out of the town when the matches were going on and football. We were disciplined enough, but we were in there. We lived in there most of the time when it wasn't. So my sisters were going out, and there was she coming up to the field to kick the ball back to me and practice. So that's the only thing that stood to me, because if I didn't have 2 feet at that time, I would never have got near the team. I have no doubt about that. None.
And that's interesting, that it's because you had the five sisters, none of them would practice with you. So it was your father. It was a very good story. He used to bring you practice, and then he'd get home from work and he'd be tired. And he'd like, I'll put this lad off this now. And I'd say, listen, I'll only go with you if you just kick only with your left foot. And he says, if you kick with your right, I'm going home. And you never kicked with the right at all.
No, because I'd only one foot. You're going back, this is like, if it's 45 years or whatever, it's 46, 70. And yeah, the 2 feet, and I got going with the 2 feet very young. And, you know, I was a big believer in that. One of the few strengths I had. I had a lot of weaknesses, some of my teammates will tell you, but one of my few strengths was I had 2 feet. And by the time I was 12 or 14, it didn't matter either off either side.
How unique would that have been back then?
It was probably, listen, you don't like talking about yourself, but it was unique in one sense, because it got me out of so many holes in club football, which was tough in Meath at the time. And with underage in Meath, at minor, under 21, under 16, it did stand to me, there's no question, because there was probably very few in the county that were equal off both sides, or in Leinster. And I used to look at Mikey, she is my childhood hero. If you look back then, in Canavan and guys like that came afterwards, but to have 2 feet back then was definitely solely the only reason I was on the Munster County team, I would say, definitely.
Yeah, you told a good story about yourself and your friend Dave Sinnott. So you made your debut your first big mark on the intercounty scene in the 84 Centenary Cup, where you got 1-3 in the semi-final. By 86 then, you had won the Leinster. And your mark and Dave Sinnott, Dublin cornerback, who you work with, your two wives are sitting up in the stand. You're sitting up in the stand watching this. You're about to do a meet and greet after the match, the two of you. And you and him start blackguarding each other.
I mean, I tried to put across on the show, and it was one of the few times in my life, and Tommy Smith was another one with Leash, and that piece was left out, which is a shame, and it was no fault of anybody's. But Dave said it, and myself were great mates, and we socialized together, we worked together every day. And I'm going to tell a story that was left out, that it's fucking brilliant. This is some story, but when the people see tonight the story, we're working together. We work together every day. We're great mates. And in the previous Leinster final, had a good match in the previous match we played, but they put the left half back to cornerback with his pace. And that threw me out because I'd lunch and coffee and dinner with Dave during the week. We never spoke much about football. And they sprung that on Dave and myself. I didn't know it.
Right.
But he's clean and he was fast, but he started hitting me fists into the gut. And I had words with him, and another ball, I went for it. But anyway, I turned back and I opened him, I split him badly. And we were to meet. The two guys were sitting in the stand together, sitting. We made a pact, we'd meet afterwards, meet the 50 publicans, a big sort of meet and greet for tenants who were both reps with our Michael Gilroy and Tony Haddon, who was played it down in the 60s, the great Tony Haddon. They were our two bosses. And I came out after the match. Dave was sent off, Marie was crying, met her, she gave me a bollocking, and rightly so, probably, but I didn't care. We won the Leinster final, so I had the medal. And I went up for Dave, he didn't turn up. Never turned up to the meet and greet, and I waited around, told Sean Boyle I had to stay on, and I found him around 12 o'clock that night. And I wrote off my car that night, and it was on the programme, about 2 or 3 in the morning with Dave, and I had to do a promotion in Gibney's Malahide on the bank holiday Monday the next day. And who drove me and helped me the next day? Only Dave Sinnott. What a man.
Jesus.
He goes to the centre. So I wrote off my car. But the best one was the number ones later at my stag. Himself and Charlie Redmond came to my stag. And they came to my stag and left. They were only home. Dave was only home for his honeymoon that evening. And Marie says, listen, stay out till 12 or 1. At 5 o'clock in the morning, there was no mobiles, but we were late drinking somewhere after a nightclub. Word came back to me through a guard. David smashed his car, but Charlie was in crutches already with a bad injury. So I got a taxi out to the scene, and there's Charlie, spread eagle on the ground, crutches everywhere, and they killed the cow stone dead in the middle of the road. And Dave wrote off his car at my stag in the same year.
Jesus, they're wild days.
It was wild days, and but they left that bit out the end of it. And I only talked to Dave a while back about it, and Charlie Redmond, and we had a great crack a while ago.
I'm not surprised.
And the laugh, oh, just a joke. But when I seen the cow dead on the road, the car smashed, and I said, deja vu, Dave, night of the Leinster final. Because I stayed looking for him, and I would have had my car only if I stayed looking for him. And my stag, the same thing happened. So listen, it was the Wild West back then, but it was off-season.
Jesus, definitely. What I'm interested in is like being able to handle yourself back then, Bernard. Because like you said, you were a small enough fella, and you were the top corner forward in the game. And like you're getting these digs and you're getting these punches, and like there's nothing really else to do other than maybe throw your elbow back into the fella's stomach or even up higher if you can. Like, how did you manage, you know, taking care of yourself and not be kind of bullied around by cornerbacks? And that was kind of the trade back then.
Yeah, I mean, the first time it happened, I would have been ended up in hospital. I knocked out a good few times. The first one was with Jim McCurr, the cornerback from Armagh. I woke up in Daisy Hill Hospital in Monaghan. I'd scored a goal and a point looking for the far end of the field, and he just absolutely knocked me clean out from behind, and I woke up in the ambulance, on the way to the ambulance. But jeez, those days, them things happened quite a bit. But, I mean, I didn't wake up. If you ask me now if I could come back or wake up again in heaven, I'll come back again a second life, I would, only one thing I would do was come back and maybe do a few things to a few choice cornerbacks that I didn't do to. It's one of the few regrets I have. So while you get to learn to mind yourself, I got the wrong end of the stick most of the time, I have to say.
You're bound to be, but that's the whole danger. If anyone's listening that's a corner forward, and I've played in there, and somebody's given it to you, and you might give it back to them, but your back is to them. You don't know when this retribution is going to come. It's a very vulnerable position to be in.
No, I think that's a brilliant point. And I was trying to make that point to people so many times. Like the scene in the 86 Leinster final, the Dave Sinnott one was the 88 Leinster final, but the 86 Leinster final, I'm looking up the other end of the field and I got a ball. I'm watching the other end of the field and a pissing wet Leinster final day, a horrible day, horrible match. And he just closes his fist from behind and puts my lights out completely. And I woke, and I was knocked out completely. And that's the way it was then. And I was a bit naive. So I mean, you just learned the best you can, and it's all part of it. I'm not saying every bit of it was right, but that's the way it was back then. You went with the flow. If you went into a me dressing room before or after, and you started to moan and groan and didn't look after yourself, there's only one thing they'd be doing with you, and they'd be sorting you out. That was it. They wouldn't listen. That was it. End of story. it was.
Yeah, it was the way. Tommy Carr said you were the type of guy you wanted to get a belt at because you were a good trash talker. And I often notice I was a decent trash talker myself, Bernard, but you actually...
Never trash talked. Did
you not?
Not at all. Don't mind Tommy the bollocks, God forgive me. He's a good friend of mine here in Mullingar. And Tommy, I actually, when I seen and got the first view of it there a week or two ago, I rang him. I said, "You are some bollocks." And he busted his arse laughing on the phone and he said, "Yeah, the trash talk." I said, "Tommy, you know I never trash talk." I says, "That's nice coming from you." And I didn't actually trash talk. And a few of cornerbacks that would tell you that. Now, I didn't know. There's a few things you'd say to fellas that were at you. But Tommy's good. He's a great friend of mine and all that. But Tommy couldn't resist. Tommy would always have to have the last word at the edge. And that was his way. Now, listen, if there was ever a fella that was lined up to be hit and his belt in our dressing room, the number one at the top of the list was Tommy Carr.
Really?
Our lads couldn't hit him often enough and belt him often enough. So, I mean, it was the other way around, but Tommy with the trash talking, he's the only little white lie in the programme, and I pulled him up and we were great mates and we had a great crack about it and a bit of a laugh. That's all.
Come here, I want to talk to you about the full forward line, the Bernard Flynn, Colm O'Rourke and Brian Stafford. Like, I mean, I presume when you came in out of minor, did they put an arm around you and see the potential, like, this could be a full forward line now that we'll win something with, or how did they deal with you when you came in?
No, I was playing minor, and then I didn't play. We'd only 21 final myself and Brian Stafford beat Kildare. We lost the Nelson final in the minor against Kildare in 83. But the under 21, 2 years later, we were 6 points down, and myself and Stafford got 2-2 or 2-3 to win it. And I became very close to Brian. I was very close. What a guy! I mean, an amazing, amazing human being. Most down to earth, humble guy. Still the same staff. Very underrated. People, apart from the freeze, didn't realise how good he was with the ball. We probably didn't get enough balls from general play, but great guy. Didn't really look that was going to happen early on. But Colm O'Rourke, I've always said it, Wally, that to me, going back years, I always said he was the best and greatest meat footballer I've ever seen, the best I ever played with, without a shadow of a doubt. But it just happened, I think, around 86, 5, 6, and then it sort of happened. Now, we probably only had 6 or 7 years, good, really good years together. You've got to remember after 84, Leinster final would be my double 2 points I played, and the Senior Cup you're speaking about. We played against Leash in 85 in Tullamore and bet the shit out of us. That was the change of our whole attitude that day, Wally. The E-Boys had a great side, and we sat down after that, and the change in the training and the attitude, and Rourke was at the fore of that. But yeah, it was a full forward line. We did a lot of it on the field ourselves, Colin. We really did. I would come out an odd time when things need to be changed to half forward line for 10, 15 minutes. We'd throw a team out. Brian would do it, or Colm. And we would take a lot of that on board ourselves to make changes. Not Sean in training so much, but we had a good understanding. And there was no one selfish. Well, the boys might say I was a little selfish because O'Rourke always slags me for that. But Brian Stafford and O'Rourke were brilliant to play with. And O'Rourke was great in the physical side for trying to look after you. Maybe once or twice, and there was trash talking in odd time for Keith Barr, name and Heary, and he'd try and sort a few of them guys out as well. But I'd say they were unbelievable men, but as friends and as fellas to this day, when I look at them, I get goose pimples. When I meet them, I get goose pimples. And I look them in the eye and just say, you know, you had some little thing special going with them, but they're brilliant fellas. We get a few jars and a bit of crack going, staff, but people don't realise the fun with a rock is phenomenal fun when you get them going in the right situation, and I can always take the piss out of them, I wind them up and get the best out of them, so it's great crack. Bad days as well, you know.
He was hard as nails, O'Rourke. Like, I mean, Jesus Christ, he was one, not only was he a brilliant player, but he was as bloody tough as nails. Like, I remember the 91 final because we did this show, we did a few nostalgia shows during the first lockdown last March. And like, you were unbelievable that day. And the second, I think you got 5 of your 6 from play when O'Rourke came on, and you were, you know, getting ball off him. What struck me that day, Bernard, was from watching that whole game, kind of, you know, as an adult rather than remembering when I was a child, is the amount of shite ball that went into you. Martin O'Connell, would you not have pulled him aside and said, "Here, mate, will you give us the odd low one?"
Well, if I touch on the program with the snow coming in and the ball. Martin, in fairness, the crack when we ring each other, he'd ring me on the road regularly. I spoke to him there a week before last. And I always say and refer to Martin, I can't believe you just said that to me. I say, "Martin, oh, Martin, I say the legend with the in the stamp, the head in the stamp that could, every time he passed the ball, there was snow coming in the top. The man drove it 100 yards in the sky in on top of every time. And all you were saying, Mark, can you punt a ball in front of me, please? Is that too hard? You know, yeah. it was actually great crack, but you're right. But Mark, not a great guy, but yeah, passing the ball, snow coming down on top of you every single time, you're right.
So like, I mean, did you ever look at the football then, maybe in the noughties, where there was much more control ball going in and going, like, that's the football that you were kind of born to play?
I know. So listen, Robbie O'Malley refers to it, and the way it was in me, they didn't, you know, we tried to change and it was very hard, if you like. Now, Liam Harnan became very good at passing the ball, punting off his foot. Mick Lyons coming out, they did evolve, you know, and there were players like at the time around the middle third of the field. That's the way football, when I came on the meeting first, the boys would get the ball and it was like hurling. They thought it a hurl. Drive it as far and as high and as long as you can. Yeah. That's the way it was, type of thing. But in Meath, you were expected to win or to contest the ball. And if you let an opponent just walk out with the ball, I mean, that was a big black mark against you. So in one way, it helped you try and win some ball that maybe you shouldn't have contested. And that was no harm either. But the odd time, it would have been nice. When you look back at some of the football, it wasn't great. I know that. But I'd love to get some of the ball the boys are playing in now, in front of the corner, like forward, like yourself. You just get it coming out onto it. But listen, that's the way of the world. That's the way it was. And I tell you, when I used to complain at meetings and stuff like that, or say it, tell you one thing, the next night of training, they'd make sure you didn't complain the following night.
But that's the thing. I'd say you'd obviously, like, that was the football then. Is looking back on it, you can't compare. It's hard to compare eras. But, like, looking back on it, and I started, you know, in the 90s when it was, I look back at some matches then, and I'd be wondering, why did I just drive that down the field? I'd be playing wing back. But, like, I mean, that was the football. And instead of you knowing those balls are coming in, you're adapting your game to maybe get a knockdown or a break, and you're in on that. And that was a skill in itself, I suppose, that's probably gone now.
It is. And the one thing I got to be fair and respect, and I know we won, my career, we won as much as we lost nearly. It was three national leagues. They meant a lot back in the day. But I played nine Leinster finals. We won 5, won 4. Four All-Irelands, 5. A draw and 1, 2, and 2. So we knew both sides of it. But I can't emphasise, or the programme doesn't do any justice, really. To, when I say, Colm, GA teams in the history, I don't think I ever met a more honest and committed bunch on the field when it was going for 50-50 ball. That's the one thing about, you know, the Lines, is the McEntees, the Harnans, the O'Malleys, O'Connells, like the way they put their body. It wasn't dirt, don't get me wrong, we had a few tough guys, Foley and Kyle and fellas like that, but what I'm saying is going honestly for the ball. Their will, their attitude and their unbelievable will to win and die to win that ball for their teammates was something to behold. And I don't think they got the credit for that, a lot of those players, because they were I speak to the Dublin players that we played against, and Tommy Carr would sit in my house over the years and a glass of wine or beer, and he'd be actually telling me about incidents and times that they couldn't believe. They never met that before, that ferocity of putting their bodies, no regard what way to put their bodies on the line to win the ball. So I think that's what they stood for more, sudden flair and skill and stuff like that. But a few of us tried to change it, but we were knocking our heads against the brick wall at times.
Come here, the show talked about your Mullingar Shamrocks connection, and you won four count, or well, you were injured maybe for what were one or two of them. You won at least two on the field anyways. You have a Laois connection too. You transferred to St. Joseph's in 1991, and because you were in business in Pedigree Corner. So anyone listening from Carlow, Kilkenny, Kildare or Laois will know about Pedigree Corner. And it was kind of a famous old kind of bar nightclub where there could be some fierce battles played out in the car park outside afterwards. But you ran that, or you owned that for 2 years, and you actually transferred to St. Joseph's in Laois.
And just down the year when I went down that time with Michael in the business and the whole lot, we bought a nightclub, and that piece is in the show. And I'd no saying it, and I don't really understand it was left out of your life, type of thing. But anyway, they couldn't fit everything in. But Michael Dempsey was my best man at my wedding, one of my great friends, and an absolute class guy, a gentleman. Tommy and Anne Dempsey, I'd know them all well at their wedding, and Tommy was sent off, Martin Meehan, in the final. But yeah. great people and a great time, and probably got me a leg up to start my own business. That's what exactly it's done. But no, I won the four championships on the field with Mullingar Shamrocks. I ended up in at half time, stretched off in the hospital, one of them with a dirty belt. For the second half, I was in hospital, but I was on the field for the four of them. And look, I had 8-9 years, and the fun and the crack in Mullingar with the Dennis Caroons and the Ned Moores, the Mick O'Reillys, Tom Orsley, Mick Collins. We had a great time. When we played Screen in the Leinster quarterfinal here in Castletown, it was jammed. I mean, you couldn't fit any more in. And they had Mick O'Dowd, Trevor Giles, John McDermott, Colm O'Rourke, Willie Finnerty. They had six county players, and we beat them that day. So I had great fun, I had great memories. I'm 30 years here now, come would you believe, 30 years in Mullingar, had a business for 25 years here as well, and you know, a shop here my wife had as well. We finished up 6-7 years ago on that. So great times, great memories, great fun here with them, and the people, Alicia and Tommy Smith and Michael Dempsey and all of those. It was hard to fit everybody in. There's a beautiful piece that I thought might be in with Jim Steins as well at the time I went to say goodbye to him in Australia. So if there's a 50-minute show, I call him, I'm going to be running. My phone is off for a day or two with people that think they should have been in it or mentioned. and should have been, but I had no say in it. They did a wonderful job, but yeah, it was virtually impossible to put every piece in. And that's a little bit disappointing, but what can you do?
That's true. It's only 50 minutes when you take in the ad breaks. And like, yes, I mean, considering your kind of career and life, like, I mean, there's bound to be loads of pieces that are going to be left out. You have seem to have connections all around the country. Finish up with your injuries, Bernard, because you got riddled. And like, I mean, your knee totally messed up. And that was a collision, I think, with Mullingar Shamrocks. But your hip was something that was at you from a young age, and you just played through the pain barrier. You've had to get your hip done. You're in an awful trouble with your knee. You're in awful trouble with your back. And it kind of on the show kind of said that it was down to the hard training and stuff. But surely that was down to the punishment you got, because, you know, like, I mean, you took a terrible amount of punishment on the field.
Yeah, from a young age, I'm sure you were the same, when you go back, like, you were playing adult football at 16 years of age. Like, I was the main guy up front in junior championship and in Meath at the time, intermediate. And you were an adult footballer at 16, sometimes at 15 back then. And like the belts and the hits, yeah, they were. And that's just the way it was. But it's one of the few regrets you'd have. There was a lot of injuries. I didn't mind them. It's my fault. I take ownership of that. But around 20, I got a bad pain in my hip. And I used to actually go, my wife and my father would bring me out to the doctor before I'd be collecting on a Sunday morning regularly. I'd go to Bettystown to the doctor and get my own painkilling injections. I never told anybody because I was in fear of not making the team, being dropped. Or that was just, there was nothing else mattered in life at the time. And it didn't help. It was my own fault. It escalated the thing. But yeah, I got a hip replacement in 42, 43, knee fully reconstructed. And last Thursday, every 6 weeks I get two epidurals in my back. I have to get a spinal fusion or keep doing that. Professor Damien McCormick keeps me alive, a great little man in the Mater Hospital. So every 6 weeks I get two epidurals in my back because there's four discs on. And he's made a decision, Bernie, you've got to keep this going or it's a spinal fusion. And that was from a lot of sort of belts and bangs in the back. But as I say, I'm alive. I can manage the pain. I get through it and I'm strong mentally. It's mind over matter. But yeah, the body wouldn't be in good shape. I sort of had to give up golf and stuff like that. But hey, you know, there's more. What do you do? You either lie down or you keep going. And I know what's ahead of me. I know what I have to do. And the spinal fusion is the one I'm trying to put off. I just hope I don't have to get that. And because it's a 40% chance. So Damien McCormick, a great little man from Meath, Professor Damien McCormick, he keeps me going. When I can't get the epidurals, I can't walk. So
Jesus. Hey,
the medical profession are great. Jerry McIndy gave me a great say, Colm, I'll leave you on this. And it saved my life when I had to give up the football at the end. When he set up the meeting with Dr. Padamini, and he said, Bernard, the state you're in, he says, you have to keep up your health insurance. And through thick and thin, what saved my life, Colm, and gives me to be able to go into the hospital and get some work done. I've always kept my health insurance, and there's an awful lot of players in an awful lot worse situation than me to have no health insurance and they can't get the help they need. So I'd be thinking of those.
Right.
Brilliant, Bernard. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us. I think you're doing some work before I let you go and maybe trying to set up some sort of a help for past players. The reason I'm saying it, I spoke with Dermot McNichol a few weeks ago, and he had two hip replacements and he has two knees. He's actually couch bound waiting for new knees. Like, some of you are really bet up from that era.
Yeah, I mean, Colin O'Rourke's knee, Brian Stafford had his own hip done, and Finian Murta hip replaced. I mean, there's a number of our lads, Jerry McIntyre, only when I came out of the hospital the other day, up getting the epidurals with Damien McCormick, I rang Jerry for a cup of coffee, and he was telling me he's in for a knee replacement now. But yeah, going back to the likes of Dermot, what a player. I was, you know, played in 87, the compromise rule against Australia with him, a brilliant guy. But the amount of these guys that need it, Colm, and I threw it out there. I'm after emailing Larry McCarthy there last week on it to see, could we not, you know, lip service or a token gesture, or, you know, the GPA were trying to do something. They weren't really helping past players properly. I'm talking about something with substance to get a proper past players movement going to help players. There could be half a dozen a year, a dozen a year that really need our help, that maybe have no health insurance, they need wheelchairs, they need operations. So yeah, just throwing it out there, we got to get something going, and I'm going to try and spearhead it, but I do need help from Croke Park. And if there's anyone listening out there, past players that want to help, please get in contact, and I'd love to get something going with the right people, with the right committee, with the right attitude.
Brilliant stuff, Bernard. Thanks very much for talking to us. Look forward. Well, everyone can look forward to the show tonight. I've already seen it. It's at 9:30 on TG Car. Thanks, Bernard. Talk to you later.
Keep up the good work, buddy. Thank you. Thanks. God bless. Bye-bye.
Well, when I started running, I suppose I didn't stop. And when I got the chance to go, I said I'd stay going. So I opened up.
We're only the small little fish out there, so we are. And we're trying hard to make it through. But it's hard to get the breaks when you're the smaller fish.
Because I love this county so much, you know. And it's just, I'm delighted that the lads did it for the people of Waterford today, because, like, I'm heartbroken.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.